Well, this evening we're going to look at an overview of the Second Great Awakening. We had completed looking at the First Great Awakening last week. And, of course, Second Great Awakening, it occurred in Britain, occurred in continental Europe and North America. The date of the Second Great Awakening is considered to be 1780 to 1810. This revival differed in several aspects from its earlier counterpart during the 1740s. For one thing, it was longer. Whereas the first ended abruptly, almost like switching off an electric light, the second faded gradually, like the coming of the night. Furthermore, the second had no truly outstanding persons involved in it, whereas the first featured the intellectual giant Jonathan Edwards and the masterful orator George Whitefield. The second came about through the coordinated labors of many men of smaller stature. Theologically and spiritually, the New England phase of the Awakening followed in the footsteps of Edwards. Acting in accordance with his famous call, the leaders of the Second Awakening gathered together for seasons of concerted prayer. They assisted one another in preaching ministries, but no great single personality arose to unite the whole in one vocal expression. In some respects, many felt that because the Second Awakening was not dominated by a few strong figures, it was a purer and sounder movement. It was carried on by settled pastors who lived in the communities where the revivals took place and stayed to attend them. In fact, itinerant evangelists were looked upon with suspicion. During the First Awakening, some roving evangelists such as James Davenport became fanatical in their methods and were instrumental in corrupting the Awakening and finally bringing it to a halt. For this reason, many pastors were reluctant to invite freelance-type preachers into the churches. In the opinion of many who lived at the time, the revivals of the Second Awakening, though just as powerful as those under Edwards and Whitefield, were attended with fewer extravagances such as visions, trances, and violent bodily movements, in New England at least. They had fewer superficial converts and were more lasting in their results. The universal testimony of the preachers of the period is that the overwhelming majority of converts were true to their profession, provided a framework of strength and stability in the churches and communities. From the standpoint of evangelical piety, the years between the two awakenings were years of decline and spiritual deadness. There are few revivals and wickedness seemed to be getting the upper hand. It was a day of rampant infidelity, open ungodliness in society, and of apathy in the churches. Heman Humphrey, one of the foremost authorities on revivals during the first quarter of the 19th century, compared this period to the time when the children of Israel were in the wilderness, only kept alive by supplies of the heavenly manna and of the water from the rock. Jonathan Edwards seemed to have forebodings of this period. He regarded Braddock's defeat at Fort Duquesne in July of 1755 as evidence of God's displeasure against the colonies. In the fall of 1756, he wrote to a chaplain of a Massachusetts regiment at Lake George, "God need is remarkably frowning upon us everywhere. Our enemies get up above us very high, and we are brought down very low. What will become of us, God only knows." The French and Indian threat was eventually quelled, but while the danger lasted, it caused universal alarm and absorbed the minds of virtually the entire population. The agitations of the French and Indian War seemed to quench the last embers of the Great Awakening and precipitate a decline. Scarcely was this war over when the difficulties between the colonies and the English motherland began to increase to the boiling point. The Revolutionary War itself was an occasion of much mischief spiritually. Many of the restraints of more settled communities were broken down among the revolutionary soldiers on the battlefield, and as a result, flagrant sin was widespread. Intemperance, profane swearing, disregard for religious institutions, bitterness and hardness, and other forms of moral dissipation prevailed. After the war, troops carried these vices back into their communities. All in all, the social and political conditions of the country were hurtful to the cause of Christ, and militated against the prosperity of the churches. As the century began to draw to a close, the French infidelity rose to challenge the church. Destructive philosophical notions began to influence the minds of many Americans. Thomas Paine's Age of Reason was thought by many to herald the demise of traditional Christianity, and infidels such as Volney and Voltaire boldly predicted that the Bible would soon become the relic of the Dark Ages, suitable only to bemuse the superstitious. Clearly, another awakening was sorely needed, lest the colonies rise in the glory of a newly found independence only to sink in the ruins of moral desolation. Many Christians wondered if their new political institutions would be erected on the ruins of their Puritan traditions. The outbreak of revivals which began in the 1790s provided just such a relief as was needed. And this quote is taken from the 10 Greatest Revivals Ever. says, on both sides of the Atlantic, the Enlightenment religion known as deism was spreading. Deists denied the reality of God's revelation or intervention in history, rejecting any notion of the supernatural. Deism, in fact, became so popular in Europe and America that the French infidel Voltaire boasted that Christianity would be forgotten within 3 decades. Because the erosion of the faith was such a great concern, one after another, Christian denominations began to call the faithful to prayer. In England, the first Monday evening of each month was set aside for prayer. 2 items were high on the prayer list. First, the churches prayed for a revival that would restore many who had lapsed into secularism. Second, they prayed for an extension of God's kingdom into the unreached nations around the world. Within a decade, the movement of prayer in Great Britain was duplicated in the United States and many other nations. The story of the Second Great Awakening that followed is thus a story of God's bringing revival to praying saints and giving birth to a renewed missionary vision in the church. The outpouring of the Spirit that fell on these meetings impacted the evangelical church for half a century. This is in the British Isles. Even with the death of John Wesley in 1791, Methodists continued to embrace the new awakening that was similar to the revival that had given them their spiritual birth. Baptists and Congregationalists also report revival in their churches, as did evangelicals within the Anglican Church. Revival among the Anglicans in the London upper-class suburb of Clapham empowered some of the most influential members of British society, William Wilberforce, John Howard, Elizabeth Fry, who produced some significant social reforms. But at the same time, the Welsh began reporting the blessing of God in their midst. Churches were packed with people seeking God, and thousands gathered in open-air meetings to hear the gospel preached. Here, as in England, Baptist Congregationalists and Methodists reported significant church growth during the revival. Many cities in Scotland also reported phenomenal awakenings. The Haldane brothers, James and Robert, preached to large crowds in major cities, and pastors such as Thomas Chambers won many in their region for Christ. The Irish Rebellion of 1798 reflected the pain of a disenfranchised majority in Ireland, yet despite the social unrest, both Methodists and Evangelicals when the Church of Ireland experienced revival. Societies were established throughout the country for the purpose of evangelizing the nation and encouraging the cause of revival in the churches. And in the early 19th century, the revival begun in Britain across the English Channel to touch various European nations. Revivals in Scandinavia actually began prior to 1800, and resembled the early awakening under Wesley and Whitfield in England. The movement was largely advanced by laymen such as Hans Nielsen Haug in Norway and Paavo Rautiainen in Finland. But various national evangelists also had a significant role, including British Methodist George Scott, who won many Swedes to Christ. In the rest of Europe, the revival was delayed by the Napoleonic Wars. The visit of Robert Haldane to Geneva, Switzerland, however, began what came to be called Geneva's Second Reformation. His ministry among students had a lasting impact not only in Switzerland, but also throughout France and the Netherlands. The awakening in Germany that followed the defeat of Napoleon produced scores of evangelists, missionaries, and social reformers. According to historian J. Edwin Orr, next to British evangelical pioneers, the German revivalists achieved the most lasting social reforms. Close collaboration between British and German revivalists existed in home and foreign mission projects. In North America, the limited revivals in the 1780s produced the leaders of the wider awakening in the decades following. Sporadic revivals began breaking out in New England in 1792. The Baptist pastor Isaac Backus of Connecticut and others began organizing concerts of prayer, following the model established in Britain. By 1798, New England was experiencing a general awakening. Congregations were crowded to capacity. A deep conviction was common in many services, resulting in significant conversions. Virtually every New England state was affected, as were all the evangelical denominations. The revival spread south to the mid-Atlantic states, then west across the Alleghenies. North of New England, the maritime provinces of British North America experienced the New Light revival. Evangelist Henry O'Lean and others impacted Baptist and Congregational churches with the revival message. Methodists conducted camp meetings and established new churches throughout Upper Canada. The revival later touched Presbyterians in the same region.